Mark chapter 8. Mark chapter 8. In those days, the multitude being of very great and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the multitude because they have now continued with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar. Then the disciples answered him, How can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness? He asked them, How many loaves do you have? And they said, Seven. So he commanded the multitudes to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to his disciples to set before them, and they set them before the multitude. They also had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000, and he sent them away. Immediately got into the boat with his disciples and came to the region of Dalmanutha. Then the Pharisees came out and began to dispute with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven, testing him. But he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, Why does this generation seek a sign? Assuredly, I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. And he left them, and getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they did not have more than 1 loaf with them in the boat. Then he charged them, saying, Take heed, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, It is because we have no bread. But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, Why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? And they said to him, 12. Also, when I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? And they said, 7. So he said to them, How is it you do not understand? We'll stop our reading there today. Henry Ford was a very successful businessman, had great success with the Model T, but he nearly failed due to a rigid adherence to business practices and not adapting to the desires of his customers. He was able to get things turned around. He recognized the situation, made adjustments, and eventually got the company back in order. Babe Ruth held the record for the most home runs. He also held the record for the most strikeouts. That isn't the worst of it. He also nearly ruined his career by his arrogant and unruly behavior off the field. Thomas Edison, we know him from his experiments with the light bulb. Those experiments lasted for years, and he had mass failures. And he said, I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that didn't work. Alexander Graham Bell was known for the invention of the telephone. What we might not realize is that he also had great interest in aeronautics. And he designed several ideas for airplanes, And he even built prototypes. And one time he took his prototype out and tried to pilot it. It was kind of a kite-type aircraft. And he crashed it on the very first attempt. And he walked away from it, and he never looked back. He completely discarded his interest in airplanes. There's a lot of failure. And most people who have experienced some success have experienced failure. And they've overcome that failure to one degree or another. Some of them have that attitude like Edison, just found 10,000 ways it doesn't work. The next one might work. I'm going to keep trying. I'm going to get up and do it again tomorrow. Other people have the perspective of Alexander Graham Bell. Once he failed, he walked away from it and didn't return to it at all. We can look at Jesus and his disciples, and at this point, you'd look at Jesus as having failed. He has 12 men he specifically called, and they had some early successes. They followed him, they listened to him, he sends them out. They went out preaching, they cast out demons, they came back, they were a great success. But at this point, they're a failure. Spiritually hard-hearted. Spiritually, they are not able to hear, they're not concerned of spiritual things, they're not thinking and processing life properly. And Jesus really lays it on to them. Toward the end of our passage, are you still hard-hearted? You have eyes, but you don't see, ears, you don't hear. Sometimes we wonder, did Jesus ever get frustrated? I think he did in the human aspect of his life. He didn't sin in that frustration, but you can see it in our text. He has reached the pinnacle of his popularity, and yet he knows that the multitudes are going to turn against him. They really aren't there for the spiritual food. They're not listening to what he's teaching. He gives the Pharisees opportunity after opportunity, and all they can come up with is a hatred for him and his work. And he sighs deeply. From the disciples' perspective, what a failure. This failure was really more about them than it was about Jesus. As we take up our text today, there's a few things I want us to observe, hopefully to keep us from being this kind of a failure. Or if we sense spiritual failure in our lives, what do we do? And what kind of a response do we have toward that? Are we going to overcome those things and continue on with Christ, or are we going to be like the Pharisees and harden our hearts even further? Chapter 6, verse 31 through chapter 7, verse 37 kind of parallels our passage. Mark has used a style of writing. He's selected certain things out that created two lines of story that match up to some degree. Now, critics would like to look at this and say, well, the Bible isn't true, that it just taken two different fables and put them in here, or maybe people observed one thing and they put it in here twice. Obviously, that is not true. Jesus Christ himself makes it a point that this happened twice. He feeds the 5,000, he feeds the 4,000. Two different times. We don't know the exact period in between them. There has to have been some time that has passed, but very likely within the same year. So this isn't like ancient history here, but you look at the text and you can see that you have the feeding of the multitudes. Then they get in the boat and they cross the sea. Then they have a conflict with the Pharisees, a conversation about bread, and then a healing, and then a confession of faith. And so he repeats that a second time. And when things are repeated, it's important for us. These are lessons that we really have to stop and consider. He's trying to drive something home to us. In both of these, Mark gives us a miracle that the other Gospels did not give us. We know that Jesus did many things that are not recorded. Mark gives us two that the others did not. And so he's very intentional in the way that these passages are laid out. The first miracle was in Galilee. As we come to our text in verse 1, it says, in those days. And we need to remember back a couple weeks before we saw that Jesus had left Galilee. He had left Israel. He's outside the boundaries and ministering in the area of the Decapolis. The main group of people living in that area were Gentiles. And so as we look at this, he says, in those days in which he was ministering outside of the boundaries of Israel. What a blessing that is to us. Jesus feeds the multitudes in Israel. The multitudes reject him. Israel is rejecting him. He takes his message to the Gentiles, and he ministers to them with the same compassion, with the same urgency, with the same personalness, with the same power that he ministered to the people of Israel. Romans chapter 10 and verse 12. For there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord over all is rich to all who call upon him. For whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. This is such a blessing, and I think maybe plays a part into the disciples' failure. They had been raised up in such a mindset that Israel was God's chosen people. They had become rather prejudiced. They couldn't imagine that God would love a Gentile, that God would minister to a Gentile. And I wonder how much that played into the fact that Jesus is having compassion on these multitudes and they respond with, well, how is one to feed the multitude in the wilderness? I mean, you read through there and you just stop and you're like, did I hear you right? You just, you know, some short time before saw Jesus do that exact thing. Why is this any different for you? Why is this any different? Well, one of the differences is we're not in Israel anymore. Maybe God's power is limited to Israel. Maybe God's compassion and his love is limited to Israel, and God wouldn't give the power to feed multitudes of Gentiles. Maybe that was part of their reasoning. We kind of try to figure out why, because it's so unreasonable that they should be where they are right now. But for us, it is a blessing to know that the God who provided food for the multitudes of Israel, provided food for multitudes of Gentiles. He is compassionate for us just as much as he is for his chosen people. He loves us. Notice the dedication of these people. In the feeding of the 5,000, they had run around the lake. All of that had taken place in one day. Here he's with the Gentiles, and they have come out in the multitude, and they have been with Jesus for 3 days. Some of them have come from a great distance. Look at the dedication. How sad it is to hear sometimes people complain about the time it takes to serve the Lord, or the time that takes to go to church, or the time that the pastor overruns his message by 5 or 10 minutes. These were so committed that they came out and listened to Jesus for 3 straight days. And whatever food they may have had was gone. Probably that first day. They wouldn't have had a plan to do this. And for 2 days, they sat there without food to listen to Jesus speak on spiritual things. I don't know about you, but fasting would be one of the hardest things in the world to do. Maybe you've done it. Maybe you've got a habit of it. Great. But to get through a day without putting food and Mountain Dew in this body, that's rough. But to have that kind of commitment. So they're sitting here hungry. And Jesus knows exactly how hungry they are. He knows their physical condition. He knows that if he should send them home and they have a long way to go, they would faint on the way. They wouldn't have the strength to accomplish it. And so he has compassion upon them. In verse 4, his disciples answered him, "How can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness?" How can one satisfy? What failure of comprehension. They did not comprehend the work of God. They did not comprehend the message of God. They did not comprehend the power of God. They did not have the faith that Jesus Christ was able to do this. They had seen it with their own eyes before, but now they have such hardened hearts that this doesn't even come to mind. I don't think, as you look at the text, they are not reasoning. They are not thinking these things through. Somehow, they must be telling themselves, this time is different. How many times do we fail in obedience because we think somehow things are different today? How many times do we fail in faith because we think that there's something unique about my situation? Somehow, God works for others, but he doesn't work for me. God had compassion upon the multitudes back in the gospel times, but he somehow wouldn't have that compassion for me. Something's different. He meets the needs of others, but he won't meet my needs. Others have had hardships and difficulties, but there's something different about my hardship or difficulty that somehow removes it outside of the knowledge of God, or moves it outside of the power of God, or moves it outside the compassion of God. We somehow think that our situation has somehow escaped God, and we fail. We fail in being obedient to God, and we take things into our own hands. We try to live our life according to our wisdom and our fleshly desires. We live ungodly lives. Are you less loved than the multitude here? You're not. God so loved the world that he sent his only son. His love for you is just as equal to the love that he has for these people. Is he less observant of your life? He looked upon the multitudes and he saw that they had a need. He saw that they were hungry, that they had been without food for 3 days, and he saw that. Is he less observant of your life? No. He sees everything about your life. His thoughts toward you are beyond number. You can't comprehend how much God thinks about you. God cares. Is he less compassionate toward you than he is towards these people? They were just hungry. I've got real problems, right? If only my problem today was just being hungry. I've got real struggles. I've got real issues. If your suffering is worse than hunger, do you think God's compassion isn't upon you? He cared about these people who were hungry. And he cares about you. Is he any less able? He multiplies the bread miraculously to supply the need of these multitudes. Is he less able to minister to your need today? Well, we don't see miracles today. Well, maybe we do. When we have faith, maybe we could, if we would commit ourselves to the Lord and to put ourselves into his hands. He is able. He does care. He is observing. He does love you. What can one do? I think it was a statement of doubt, and really, I'd like to turn it into a statement of contemplation. What can one do? What about your life? How can the Lord use you? What can one person do? Does one person matter to God? You think about it. David killed Goliath. He was an individual, one man, one young man, with a sling and a stone and a belief in God. Barnabas discipled outcasts. He took Paul alongside of him and ministered with him, and then he took John Mark. And what was the result? Paul becomes a missionary and spreads the gospel to the Gentile world. John Mark is restored into ministry, and he writes the gospel that we're reading today. It was just one man, Barnabas, who took him alongside and ministered to those men. What can one man do? William Carey started the modern missions movement. He was but one man with a map. In 1865, Hudson Taylor started the China Inland Mission. And at times he didn't have enough to buy food or pay his rent. Is that an obstacle to God? What can one man do? R.G. Letourneau dedicated his business to the Lord, and he was able to give and give and give to the Lord's work and to be a gospel testimony and preached the gospel and saw many saved. Answers in Genesis. One man started a bookstore in Australia. He had the wrong accent to be a communicator in America, but now we have a wonderful creation museum that is giving the gospel to thousands each year. The list can go on and on as you realize that almost anything that gets done was started by one. You can look at that in the business world. Oftentimes their name is on it. And because of their skill, because of their wisdom, because of whatever they had to bring to the situation, they were able to start something great. But when you look at these men, it's not so much about what they brought to it. They were young, they were weak, they were broke, they were inhibited in some way. It's not what one man can do in his own power, in his own wisdom, in his own strength. It's what can God do with one? What can God do with me? And maybe I feel a struggle and I feel like a failure. Maybe I'm like the disciples and I just feel like I'm not getting it spiritually. I've been saved for these many years and I should be better off than I am now. And we get the focus in the wrong place. But what happens? He asks them, "How many loaves do you have?" And that's a question for us today. What is your loaf? And what happens is they bring their loaf and they submit it to Jesus. They place it in his hands. And in the hands of Jesus, it was multiplied. Now we go back to the feeding of the 5,000, and they fed them and they took up the leftovers. And the basket that they used would have been like a lunch box. Does anybody even use lunch boxes anymore? When I was going to school, we took lunch boxes to school. And they're not very big, but you fill that up, you'd have enough food for yourself for a couple of days. So they submitted what they had into the hands of Jesus Christ. He multiplied it, he met the needs of many, and in the process, they received back more than they gave him. They received back enough to meet their need. Now, in the second situation, they submit to Jesus a loaf of bread, and he multiplies them. And when they take up the scraps, they take them up in baskets. And these baskets are the kind of baskets that they let Paul down in over the wall. So they were big enough that a guy could you know, right inside of it. Instead of 12, they take up 7, but realize that 12 of those little lunch boxes could have fit inside one of these big baskets. I wonder, what did they do with all that bread? Each basket would have been enough for that a baker would carry with him and sell his goods. What did they do with 7 baskets full? They could not have eaten that much bread before it would have spoiled. God gave back to them enough that they could continue to minister further. They probably gave it away as they went on their journey, coming and finding somebody in need, and gave more away. So as we submit what we have, what is your loaf of bread? Say, "Well, I'm not smart. I can barely read. I'm not rich. I don't have a lot of influence. I don't. And we compile all of these excuses about how poor and pathetic we are. Fine. What's your loaf of bread? What is it that you have been given by God that you can submit back into his hand that he would be able to bless? So oftentimes we look at how little we have and we think in terms of, it's not enough for me. I can't submit it to God because I don't have enough right now. But in submitting it to God, they were never short of their personal needs. They received back enough. You don't submit it to God, what are you going to find out? That it's not enough. It's never going to be enough. There's some reluctance here with the disciples, I think. So he takes the 7 loaves and he gives thanks. He broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And they set before the multitude. They also had a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. Well, Jesus asked for bread. So we have these loaves of bread. And we'll submit our bread into his hands, but we're holding the fish behind our back. We've got this fish over here we're kind of keeping for ourselves. Maybe you've submitted something to the Lord and you've seen the wonderful work that God has done with it. That God was faithful with it. That he used it for ministry. And now you're thinking, I still have these fish. Or maybe you need to think, what else? We gave the bread. He blessed. What else could I give? What else should I give? Oh, look, I have some fish. Let's give that to the Lord also. What patience Jesus has with those disciples. They also had a few small fish. What should they have given at the beginning? They should have given their all, but they held back the small fish. But Jesus doesn't reprimand them. He blesses the fish also when they submitted the fish to him. So they ate and were filled. They took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. So they get into the boat. They go across the sea. And they have this encounter with the Pharisees. Jesus sighs deeply in his spirit. He refuses adamantly, basically taking an oath, saying that they will never receive a sign. And he quickly gets back into the boat. And so some time has passed. We don't know what that time frame is, but the bread's gone. Gave it away, ate it up, whatever, sold it for their needs, whatever happened, the bread's gone. And Jesus decides to quickly get in the boat and leave the situation. And the disciples are in the boat and they realize, we don't have any food. We only have 1 loaf of bread. As they're kind of contemplating their stomach, Jesus speaks to them. And he says, take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they reason among themselves, saying, it's because we have no bread. Jesus is chastising us because we forgot the bread. No, he isn't. We didn't have enough foresight to restock the ship. We should have known that we could have gotten back in the ship and gone. What were we thinking? We got ourselves into this mess. Jesus is going to be so upset with us. Who was supposed to do that? Why? Peter? Why didn't you? Did Jesus get upset with them for their lack of foresight? He didn't. We can never foresee everything in life. And even when we should have foreseen, God is still so gracious with us. And he's able to meet our needs. He says, don't you guys get it? Why are you worried about bread? You saw me multiply the bread for the 5,000. You saw me multiply the bread for the 4,000. You think that I'm not able to take care of you? That your lack of foresight somehow takes you out of the compassion and care and providence of God? No. You still have a piece of bread. God's still going to take care of you. Jesus expected them to practice spiritual discernment outside of the religious settings. And he's very disappointed in them in not taking the spiritual lessons that they had seen and made application to other areas of their life. He doesn't chastise them for not having foresight. He chastises them for not having any spiritual insight. He chastises them for not having any faith. For being spiritually hard-hearted. He wants to teach them about the leaven of the Pharisees, but that lesson Mark sets aside. He doesn't deal with that. The whole focus here in Mark is now about their hard hearts and their unbelief, thinking that Jesus doesn't care for them and God isn't going to be able to take care of them. He tells them, in verse 15, to take heed and beware. And then he says, why are you reasoning because you have no bread? Do you not perceive nor understand? There's some churches out there which place a lot of emphasis on emotion, let go and let God. And they place no emphasis on thought. We need to have a commitment to God that we are able to let go and let God take care of things. And we need to have an emotional response to the work of God. And we ought to have a worshipful attitude and praising God. But Jesus is calling upon his disciples to engage their minds. First, he wanted them to engage their minds concerning the doctrine of the Pharisees, the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod. And then he's like, no, you've got to open your eyes and think and remember and use your brains and reason this out. Your reasoning is completely wrong. Take heed, that is, become acquainted with by experience. This gives prominence to the discerning mind. The disciples were to use their heads in their mind's eye, following out the ultimate conclusion of the acts of practicing what the Pharisees had taught. Beware. Perceive by the use of your eyes, to discern mentally, to understand, to turn your thoughts to direct your mind to a thing, to consider it. That was from Wiest. Are we engaging our minds in the spiritual? We may have formed some habits. We come to church. We sit in Sunday school. We have our daily Bible reading, but do we engage our minds? And do we engage our minds outside of the religious experience? They sat and listened to Jesus teach, and they were learning things there, but when the multitudes broke up and went their own way, and the bread was sold or given away, their spiritual thinking ended. As they went about the business of normal everyday life, their spiritual insight was gone. Engage your minds. That is, that there are things that God is using in the everyday experience of life to teach you spiritual things. And there are opportunities in the normal day of life to practice the things which you have heard. Jesus had compassion upon the multitudes. You submitted what you had to the hands of Jesus, and he multiplied it. He cares about you. He loves you. He's going to meet your needs. He's going to give you a ministry to perform with the gifts that he's given to you. And that isn't just bound up inside the walls of the church. What is your loaf of bread? Do you have some small fish? Maybe you're sitting here stinging under the rebuke and just you don't think you have the spiritual insight, you failed spiritually. What kind of perspective do you have? I found 10,000 ways that it didn't work. But I'm going to get up today and I'm going to meet with the Lord. I'm going to submit to him the things that I have and allow him to give me the success that I need. Or do we just kind of throw up our hands and say, I can't get it figured out. I don't get it. God doesn't seem to work for me. Where are we at? Let's bow our heads, shall we? Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you, Lord, for your word. And we thank you for your compassion. Your mercies do not fail. You are faithful. You do not change. Lord, help us that we would be able to submit what you have given to us back to your hand. It is oftentimes so hard because we don't have enough for ourselves. We don't reason that what you have done before you will do again. That what you've done for others, you will do for me. Lord, help us to reason properly. Help us to reason spiritually. To engage our minds as well in each aspect of life. Following out to the end what the actions, what the teachings, what the doctrine would lead us. And sometimes we're following after wrong ideas. And we have a wrong image of who you are. And that is leading us to wrong conclusions and wrong actions. Lord, convince us that you are compassionate. That you care for me. That you will meet my needs. That you will multiply what I give you to your honor and glory. That you can use one person, no matter how weak they may be. Lord, we pray your blessing upon us. In Jesus' name, amen.